So what I'll do now is introduce the entire panel. Then I'm going to encourage any member of the panel to make any kind of opening comments that they have. And then we'll have a few questions and responses. Let me start with Governor Ritter, who is obviously no stranger to those from Colorado, but since we have visitors from all over the country here, Governor, they need to know that you were elected as Colorado's 41st governor in 2006, the first Colorado-born governor in more than 35 years, raised on a small farm. From 1987 to 1990, Governor Ritter and First Lady Jeannie Ritter operated a food distribution and nutrition center in Zambia, Africa. He has also served as Denver's district attorney from 1993 to January of 2005, and I believe folks know here in Colorado that he earned in that position a national reputation as one of the country's most effective and innovative prosecutors. Several of his programs continue to serve both here in Colorado and as national models. Governor, welcome. Want to take this opportunity to welcome to the panel the Honorable Betsy Markey, who is Congresswoman, U.S. House of Representatives. Who obviously has fans in the audience. Betsy was elected to Congress in 2008 and has represented the people of the 4th Congressional District since that time. From 2005 to 2007, the Congressman served the people of the 4th District as U.S. Senator Ken Salazar's regional director for the northern and eastern parts of Colorado. Her extensive government experiences date back to 1978 when she was hired by U.S. Congressman Herb Harris to work as a legislative aide for the Subcommittee on Post Office and Civil Service. The U.S. Department of State also recruited the Congresswoman in 1984 to develop computer security policies for the newly formed Office of Information Security Systems. She's been involved and engaged in her community as president of the Board of Directors of the Food Bank of Larimer County. She is also a co-founder of a small business operation, as well as a popular and successful coffee and ice cream shop in Old Town Fort Collins, which all of you need to go to after this event. Congresswoman, thank you for coming today. Let me take this opportunity to acknowledge the Assistant Attorney General that's already been referred to by General Holder. Christine Barney was confirmed as the Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division on April 20th of 2009. Prior to her appointment as Assistant Attorney General, General Barney held leadership positions in both the public and private sectors. From 98 to 2009, she was a partner at Hogan & Hartson, a law office in Washington, D.C., where she served in a dual capacity as a member of the firm's antitrust practice group and head of the Internet practice group. From 1994 to 97, she served as a federal trade commissioner at the Federal Trade Commission and was a leading official on a wide variety of Internet and competition issues. Prior to being a commissioner, she served as an assistant to the president and secretary of the cabinet, Secretary to the Cabinet during the Clinton administration. Christine, welcome. We're also joined by two other attorney generals, the Honorable John Southers from the state of Colorado. General Southers was appointed in 2005 as Attorney General of Colorado and later elected in 2006. From 1977 to 1981, he served as Deputy and Chief Deputy District Attorney in Colorado Springs. From 1979 to 81, he also headed the Economic Crime Division of the DA's office. From 1981 to 88, he served as a litigation partner in the Colorado Springs firm of Sparks Dix, PC, was later elected to two terms as district attorney for the 4th Judicial District. At the conclusion of his second term, he returned to private practice as a senior counsel in the Sparks firm in charge of the firm's litigation section. And in 1999, he was appointed by the governor as the executive director of the Colorado Department of Corrections, then by Governor Owens. So, General, welcome. We're also joined by the Honorable Steve Bullock, Attorney General of the State of Montana. General Bullock was elected as Montana's 20th Attorney General in 2008. He began his career in public service in 1996 as a chief legal counsel to the Montana State Secretary of State. He went on to serve 4 years with the Montana Department of Justice, first as an executive assistant general and later as an acting chief deputy. During this time, he also served as a legislative director coordinating the Attorney General's legislative efforts. From 2001 to 2004, he practiced in Washington, D.C. in a private firm. He also served as an adjunct professor at George Washington University. Prior to his election, he was in private practice in Montana. And I think the last panelist that we have today is no stranger to agriculture in Colorado. Commissioner Stolpe was named Commissioner of Agriculture by Governor Bill Ritter in 2006. Farmer, rancher, has dedicated his life to Colorado agriculture. The Commissioner is an active member of the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture. He's also Vice President of the Western Association of State Departments of Agriculture. He served as a County Commissioner. He was appointed to fill a vacancy. He also served on numerous other boards and commissions, including the State Board of Agriculture, the State Wildlife Commission, the Connect Colorado Technology Committee, the State Land Board, and the Colorado Ag Development Authority and Value Added Board. I know, Commissioner, I spent several meetings yesterday, and I learned a great deal about Colorado agriculture, the diversity of it. I can tell you that he is a strong, strong, strong advocate for the farmers and ranchers of this state. Commissioner, thank you for being here. Let me invite the governor, if he wants to make a statement. We'll just kind of go in the order in which you were all introduced. Governor?
Thank you, Secretary. And I want to, first of all, actually thank and compliment the members of the administration for taking this hearing sort of to, you know, a place like Colorado where there are a lot of folks who have come from other states. It's a pretty rare thing to be in the presence of Secretary of Agriculture and Attorney General. The Assistant Attorney General is here as well. And to just have an opportunity, really, to speak your mind about this issue. And so we very much are honored here in Colorado by the fact that you've decided to come west for this hearing. Second thing I would say, I want to tell you a little bit about CSU. It is my alma mater. It's the place I graduated from. I got my undergraduate degree. I think, actually, John Stolpe has me beat. He put five kids through CSU. I only put one through, but he came back. He just started his master's program. This is a fantastic university for a lot of different reasons, but from the agricultural science perspective, it is really one of the leading institutions in research for agricultural and animal science, such as genetics, meat fabrication, and the humane treatment of livestock are all areas of study. There's just a few. That doesn't exhaust the full thing, but that's in part why we're here at this university, is because it has played this key role in the West in terms of the kinds of research that goes on and really watching livestock as an industry. You mentioned in your comments I was raised on a farm. I think it's important to keep in mind a couple of things, and that is that this conversation is in part about a market economy for cattle, a market economy for livestock and hogs, and it's important for us to ensure you know, that we've got the right set of rules, regulations in place, but there's an intangible value to agricultural activity that I experienced growing up on a farm, but I think a lot of people in this room understand when I talk about it, and it's the fabric of who we are in Colorado. Agriculture is the third biggest industry that we have in the state. We have, as you said, a very diverse agriculture economy, but there's a lot about farmers and ranchers that the rest of us who don't currently do it can learn lessons from. I have the advantage of still knowing a lot of people in the ranching world, in the farming world, and a couple times a year I still have the benefit of either Brandon with some friends of mine who have a cow-calf operation up south of Walden, or moving cattle, you know, from their place up to BLM land, and it's nice to be on the back of a horse and moving cattle, but you have an opportunity to speak to people who do it every day. And this was really what my family was about when I was a kid, but now, as a person who's kind of been away from it, it is a fantastic opportunity to remember that there are a set of values that are a part of ranching and farming that are intrinsically what I would say are American values. And they have to do with hard work. They have to do with dedication, a loyalty to the land, a loyalty, you know, to the industry, and really an attitude of how we pick each other up is an important part of it as well. The kinds of things that we need to do when our neighbor's in distress are still something that farmers and ranchers understand, I think, better than almost anybody else in America. And there's an intangible there, and that's why it's important to do what we can to ensure as wide a group as possible can participate in the industry. And I know there's different feelings in this room about the regulations, the draft regulations, and that's why you're here. But I can tell you that it is important from my perspective as a Colorado governor, as a person who kind of came off of a farm and still have a lot of friends and people I respect that are in ranching and farming, that I think what farmers and ranchers want is a fair shake. They want to understand that the rules are there and that they work for them. They're not a group of people who want to be over-regulated, and so it's a bit of a high-wire act to have regulations in place. They want the rules enforced. They want some certainty in it. But at the end of the day, at the end of the day, all they really want is that it's fair. And that, you know, if they are looking at a piece of beef in a grocery store that costs a certain amount of money, and they were really, it was their daily hard work that led to that beef getting to the market, they want to ensure that they're getting their fair shake. And I think that's the most important point takeaway. And I, again, finished the way I started by saying this is a very important industry to this state. It's important to the West. It's important to the United States. And we very much are honored by the fact that you're taking this time to handle such an important issue in really a very big town hall sort of way. So thank you both.
Thank you, Governor. Congresswoman?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Secretary, General Holder, and Governor, for holding this hearing here. It's important that we get outside of Washington and get into the communities across this country to really hear firsthand on what government regulations, how they will impact individuals. So I'm particularly happy, again, that you chose Colorado State University, our state's land-grant university, and also the 4th Congressional District of Colorado. We are one of the largest agricultural producing districts in the entire country. So it's appropriate that you hold this hearing about competition in the livestock industry here at CSU. I have been hearing, I'm a member of the House Agriculture Committee, and we have actually been holding field hearings around the country as well, talking about the 2012 Farm Bill, and this issue has come up as well. I've been hearing from constituents on both sides of the issue. And I look forward to a productive workshop and learning more. We're really here to learn and to listen. But basically, the debate has revolved around the impact of proposed changes on farm prices, on consumers, on global competitiveness, and on the traditional U.S. system of independent farms and ranches. And inherent in these questions is the proper role of government in monitoring and regulating agricultural markets. Now, some groups contend that the federal government has not enforced existing laws designed to prevent anti-competitive behavior. And they say laws should be strengthened in order to address today's market realities. But others assert that present competition and antitrust policies remain adequate and effective. The livestock industry, as we all know, is complicated and it's individualized. And ultimately, stakeholders need to be the ones with the reins in their hands. For example, many producers have worked years, even generations, perfecting herds to capitalize on value-added opportunities. And we want to make sure that they don't lose that little advantage that they have worked so many years to perfect. Thank you. I supported an extension of the comment period of the GPSA rule until November 22nd so that farmers, ranchers, and producers can understand the effect this proposed rule would have on farmer family ranching, feeding, and beef processing businesses. I hope that this workshop will shed more light on how the GPSA rule will affect the livestock industry and the constituents in my district. And again, I thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much. Assistant Attorney General Barney, I don't know if you want to add to the General's comments or not.
Very little, Secretary. Once again, I want to thank everyone for welcoming us here. I have a little bit of Colorado connection. One of my children went to college in the state, not here, but down in the Springs, and I get back here every time I can. I've got another one. I'm going to try and convince them to look here. So we like coming out here as much as we can. And I just wanted to say that we're delighted to be here. This is a historic undertaking. Never before has the Department of Justice and the Department of Agriculture sat together to take a look at the intersection of competition and agriculture policy in the United States. And America's farmers put food on the table for all of us. And there's something wrong in the system when the farmers can't make a living, when they cannot pass that farm down to their children. we all need to approach this with an open mind. We all have a part in the solution, and we don't have an agenda. I don't have an outcome. I don't know what the answer is, but I sure know there's a problem, and I'm here to try to understand what it is we can do, what I can do as the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust under the leadership of General Holder to help fix the problem, to keep American agriculture as vibrant as it's been for the last two centuries. So I look forward to hearing from everybody today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
General?
Secretary Vilsack, General Holder, thank you so much for honoring us with your presence here and choosing the state of Colorado as the venue for this meeting. And I think it's wonderful that we've chosen a venue like Colorado State University, which is a great university that's so integral to agriculture in this state. I, like Governor Ritter, am a native of Colorado, and I come to the table with two basic propositions. And it's what guides the view of my office towards agriculture. Agriculture is a huge part of the Colorado economy. You reflected that. And agricultural competition is critical to the welfare of our state and nation. I don't have a large antitrust unit in my office, but it's a unit with a great deal of expertise, and we are spending an awful lot of time examining the issues of competition in the agricultural sector, particularly the issues brought about by the tremendous consolidation that's taken place there. We're here today to learn more. The members of my office in the antitrust unit will be present at all these meetings, and we're committed to monitoring. I'll tell you a little bit, I think, in a later point about some actions that we've taken. But we're committed to preserving competition in the agricultural community for the best interests of all Coloradans.
General, thank you. General Bullitt.
Thanks, Secretary Vilsack. My family and I spent the last weekend outside the town of Geyser, and that's a small ranching community in north central Montana. We were there principally for a family wedding, but along with that, we celebrated the 100th year anniversary of that ranch. And I guess what I fear is that there'll be fewer and fewer of those centennial celebrations across my state. Over the last 30 years, Montana's lost on average over 150 ranches each year. The Secretary said what the average age of a rancher is across the country. In Montana, it's even older. Our average age is 58 years. It's now only about half of our ranchers that rely on their ranching and farming productions as their primary source of income. And 20 of Montana's 56 counties are experiencing long-term population decline. Each one of those waning counties is heavily dependent on agriculture. And I think that change in the face of rural America is likely one of the reasons why many of you traveled here today. And we each have our own definitions of what would make this and those other workshops a success. Given the size of the crowd, candidly, this morning, I decided just find a parking spot would probably be a good success from my perspective. But actually, my expectations are a lot higher than that, and I imagine that everybody in the audience is too. The fact that we're here today together, it signals a significant break from the past. I'm cautiously optimistic it demonstrates not only a renewed federal commitment to ensuring we have a vibrant agriculture sector, but also a commitment to greater state and federal coordination. Nonetheless, I think that we also have to acknowledge that bringing this many producers and ag interests together in one room is much like organizing a firing squad in a circle. Yet there are core values that we share. As the statistics I outlined a couple moments ago illustrate, we ought to be able to agree that if we value keeping the family and family farming and ranching, what we're doing hasn't been working. I'm a strong believer that you can't regulate away every problem, but I do believe that federal and state governments have a role to play here, and that in decades past, governments may have lost sight of that role. And even if we're a bit past the time where we can realistically expect to give teeth to the Packers and Stockyards Act, perhaps we could still get that 89-year-old law a new set of dentures, and I think we should look at that. I briefly, I I applaud GPSA for taking those steps to make sure that the issues that we're addressing throughout the day, everybody, contracting, concentration, marketing arrangements, and transparency are front and center in their proposed rules. At the end of the day, I think all anybody wants is a free market, willing buyers and sellers receiving the information they need to make a private deal on a relatively equal footing. I support then crafting some workable rule that will meet those standards, and I think that we need to think about some of those things, including first promoting transparency by giving producers the opportunity to learn the different types of marketing arrangements being offered. The producer's more apt to strike a deal that reflects the market, not the unequal bargaining power brought about by incomplete information. And second, clarifying what conduct is and isn't acceptable. It's interesting because as a state regulator, when I enforce my state's Unfair and Deceptive Practice Act on behalf of consumers, I don't have to demonstrate that deceptive act injured every consumer in the state. I only have to demonstrate that one consumer was injured. I think that we owe our producers at least as much as we owe the individual consumers of our respective states, and a fair reading of 202A shouldn't require that a rancher demonstrate harm to everyone. And third, I think that with giving those dentures, we need to clarify what are undue and unreasonable preferences and advantages. Big doesn't mean bad, and we should never suggest that it does. But by the same token, absent justification, we need to make sure that packers aren't unfairly discounting to our smaller and mid-sized producers that can produce the same quality as livestock and can meet the same conditions set by contract. Now, I know that there have been a lot of concerns raised about the proposed rule that we'll be talking about throughout the day. And I guess being from the big sky country, I'm not quite willing to concede that the sky's fallen quite yet. I'm hoping that the rulemaking process will allow the opportunity for GPSA to separate the wheat from the chaff, or more appropriate here, to steer clear from any bull that might be out there. And I hope to hear from Montana ranchers as we work on crafting our states and potentially other states' responses in these GPSA's comments. And if the small packer has real concerns, we need to hear that. And if the producers, if there's something, this notion that producers could get injured by these rules or that more consolidation could occur, we need to hear that also. And the extended comment period actually provides that opportunity to get that clarity. Because if we return to those shared values of the ranch being able to be passed on to the next generation, I hope that we can at least agree that the status quo ain't working and doing nothing is no longer an option. Like, we need meaningful enforcement of laws that were set up a century ago to make sure that folks get a fair shake. And in the meantime, it's also important to recognize Montana producers have been innovating. They've been employing technology by working together, by even expanding niche and value-added beef markets. As we work to promote transparency and competitiveness in the market, as regulators, we must make sure not to stifle those innovations. Lately, and in close, I guess I've been saying that solutions to the competition issues that we face can be found in bullwhips, blackberries, and some degree of bureaucracy. What I mean to say is this: if we as a nation truly value a vibrant ag sector to our economy, we need to draw on the strengths and expertise of the on-the-ground producers. We need to draw on cutting-edge technology and ranch innovations and common-sense government enforcement and regulation. Each is indispensable. There are core values each of us share. Republicans are Democrats, liberal are conservatives, stock growers are cattlemen, RCAF or NCBA. I've never, ever heard a rancher say they didn't want their children to have the viable operation to continue the family business if they so choose. So if nothing else, I hope that as we go forward, ensuring that family farming and ranching is viable for today and tomorrow's producers should be that shared focal point as we move forward. Thanks so much.
Thanks, General.
Mr. Secretary and Mr. Attorney General, thank you very much for coming to Colorado. This is a very appropriate place to conduct this sort of a hearing. Here at Colorado State University, well known for their land grant contribution to the livestock industry and innovators in so many areas. As I look across this audience, I recognize a number of friends and neighbors. I recognize leadership from the Colorado livestock industry, and you're going to be hearing from them later today. And I think it's important to point out they're well-respected in their particular areas of interest and passion. We are home in Colorado to some of the largest livestock operations, some of the largest packing operations in the world. At the same time, we have some of the smallest operations. They're using the internet and other marketing tools to their advantage, and we're seeing a great interest in our farmers markets and our direct marketing from the farm to the table and the different homes. And so we have a great diversity of interests here in Colorado. You're going to hear a lot of that diversity and legitimate differences of opinion today. And so once again, thank you for coming to Colorado. I think you'll hear a great testimony today.
Commissioner, thanks very much. Going to have about a half an hour for a few questions, and so General, I'm going to start it off with you if I can. I think it would be helpful for the audience to have a basic understanding of how you see and how you perceive the role of the Department of Justice in responding to concerns that folks may express about transparency, about competition and concentration.
Okay, I think that's actually a very good question. Unlike the Department of Agriculture, the Justice Department is not an agricultural regulator. That's not what we do as our primary function. We have a more narrow but I think important role, and that is that we enforce the antitrust laws and we are a voice for competition advocacy. We are trying to make sure that things are done in a fair way. The antitrust laws prohibit conduct that stifle competition. That's what we focus on. We want to make sure that competition is not stifle. That's what Christine lives and breathes. We want to take aggressive action against conducts that violates those antitrust laws. We think that this will result in better prices for producers that are selling their livestock, and also for consumers at the retail level, at their grocery shelf. Our enforcement efforts include a variety of things. We challenge mergers. I think I talked about this 2008 challenge that we made to JBS's proposed acquisition of National Beef Packing Company. We thought that acquisition would have lessened competition among packers for the purchase of fed cattle and in the production and the sale of USDA graded boxed beef. Again, something that we thought would have stifled competition, and so we intervened. There are rare instances where the Justice Department will bring criminal enforcement actions. These are not as common. For example, we have brought criminal cases against Archer Daniels Midland for fixing the prices of livestock and poultry feed additive, and against Hoffman LaRoche for fixing the price of vitamins used as animal feed additives. Again, that's not something that is as common as what we do on the civil side, but I think is a reflection of the tools that the Justice Department has and is willing to use where it is appropriate. The antitrust laws are not a cure-all for the problems that face ranchers and farmers. We don't hold ourselves out in that way. But we think that in conjunction with other laws and other regulations that are more specifically designed to protect those rights of individual farmers and advance their interests, that in combination with those other laws and working with our partners at the Department of Agriculture, that we can be very effective. We can be most effective in protecting those rights. The department at base acts as an advocate for fair competition. I think, as somebody said, we don't view big as necessarily bad. That is not our view. From our perspective, fairness is the key to make sure that there is a level playing field for competitors, whatever their size. We want to try to encourage more competition and transparency in the agricultural sector. And so that is a general way in which I think the Department of Justice sees its role in this very important sector. A sector that's important not only for our exports and our economy, but also for the American way of life. Now, I'm, unlike everybody else, it seems, you know, I was born and raised in New York City. and don't hold that against me. But there is a reality to the fact that from the earliest parts of this nation, a vital agricultural sector, and the values that are associated with it have defined this nation and have really made this nation different from so many others. And even as a New York City guy, I get that and understand that. And I think that in my time at the Department of Justice with my partner, Christine Barney, that we will do our part to ensure that that part of our nation, that part of our culture remains vital.
General, you mentioned the issue of competitiveness, and I want to turn to you, Congressman Markey, to talk a little bit about this. You're out there, you're campaigning, you're listening to folks. What are the farmers and ranchers that you're meeting telling you about the competitiveness and the openness and the transparency of the market? What are you hearing about access to markets?
Well, I think one of the things that we're hearing is uncertainty with the proposed GPSA rule, how far will it go, and making sure that it's going to benefit both consumers and producers, and that concern that any future government intervention maintains the competitiveness in this marketplace, and that it's not a future haven for attorneys and potential lawsuits. So, again, I greatly appreciate the fact that we need to move slower on this, that we extend the comment period to make sure that what we're doing is right. But it's, as you know, it's a complicated issue. It's a diverse issue with some groups feeling that again, that the laws that there are existing laws that we should keep and that should be strengthened and enforced, and others that say that, you know, the current laws are adequate, and that structural changes are just an outgrowth of what's going on currently in the marketplace. But I think in the end, producers want to make sure as well that they are getting a fair price for their product, and that individual farmers, ranchers are making sure that they can keep their competitive advantage in the marketplace. So, again, it's a delicate issue of balancing how much enforcement should take place, and again, what's the proper role of government.
Governor Ritter, I want to ask you a question. You actually come to this from a number of directions. You mentioned your early experience living on a farm. You've been a prosecutor and now a governor. I'm interested in your thoughts in terms of what you believe we need to be looking at, in your view, to make sure that those livestock producers, regardless of size, are able to actually have a level of independence over their operations and be able to continue the value system that you talked so eloquently about.
Well, I do think that the market, at the end of the day, is going to dictate that. So much of what we've heard about the consolidation has to do with the market economy that just doesn't support small producers remaining in business. If you look at our 20-year history of agriculture generally, this is farming and ranching. I said it was the third biggest industry, but it survives at the thinnest margin. So 20-year history, it's 2 to 3% profit margins over that time if you average it out. And you know this, you go through losses, and you know there's some really good years and there's some tough years. That's commodity marketing. But anti-competition or anti-competitive practices within the market economy absolutely can harm it. And we all know that, and that's why I think the Department of Justice is here and is intent upon looking at the impact of that. We want a good price for the consumer. We want meat and pork to be placed on the plate at the home in a way that is affordable, and yet at the same time, we want to make sure that we're doing all we can to regulate the market, not too much regulation, not too heavy the regulation, but regulate it so that you take out the competitive practices. What I would say is one of the things we must focus on, I think this is as a country, is the ability to expand the access to export markets. And that's, I think, a reality that we should, as a country, focus on, because consumption in the United States is likely to dwindle over time as a percentage of, you know, all food consumed, beef and pork likely to dwindle. But you look at emerging economies around the world, China, India, places like that, there's actually greater beef consumption that's happening in those places. And for, you know, a variety of reasons, we can take advantage of those expanding markets and then in a sense, in maybe an indirect way, help that small producer. But I do think, you know, it's a difficult place because we value the family farm, we value the family ranch, and yet there's a lot about that that's made it more and more difficult. People are staying in there sometimes at financial loss to them and to their family just because they believe in it. And so it won't all be done by regulation. It won't all be done by trying to do what you can to take out anti-competitive practices. In those parts of the industry, they're heavily consolidated, but it can help. It can help. And I don't think the margin has to get a whole lot better than 2 or 3% to be able to reverse the trends that we've seen in the consolidation and the lessening of family farming. And so I think the number one thing is expanding access to markets. And finally, I'd say this issue about ensuring that the regulations allow for direct marketing and in a way allowing the rancher to directly market to the consumer and take, in some respects, some of the retail middleman out of that, so don't regulate it so heavily that it's impossible for that. That's a great benefit, and that's a great benefit to a variety of the small producers that John Stolpe referred to, particularly the niche producers that have something that they can offer that really distinguishes them but may get lost if they go through the entire sort of, if they have to go through the entire process from wholesale to retail. There's a lot that can get lost in that. Thank you.
Well, I can't help but comment about exports. This will be the second best year in exports in ag in the history since we've been keeping records. We anticipate about $105 billion of ag exports, led in part by the livestock industry, and we'll have about a $28 billion surplus, which is one of the few places in our economy that actually has a trade surplus. And every $1 billion of ag trade also generates somewhere between 8,000 and 9,000 jobs. I see a lot of folks from the UFCW here today who are working in those processing facilities, and that means employment opportunities as well. So you're absolutely correct, and we are focused on increasing exports. The president has charged us with, as economy and as an administration, doubling exports over the course of the next several years. I want to direct this next question to the two state attorney generals who are here. You all have offices that obviously receive phone calls and complaints and letters. I'm interested to knowing whether or not you've seen an increase or of concerns as the economy tightens and as farm families have difficulty. And if so, what may be causing that, and what protections can you provide at the state level to complement what can be done at the federal level?
Well, like the United States Department of Justice, the Colorado Department of Law is not an agricultural regulator per se, but our jurisdiction comes from the antitrust laws of Colorado and also the deceptive trade practice laws of Colorado. And I have to tell you that over the last several years, virtually all the concerns that have been expressed to our office about the agricultural industry in Colorado and throughout the United States have revolved around consolidation. Particularly, the last several years, there's been a lot of concern expressed to our office by agricultural interests in Colorado about consolidation among packers. And it was our analysis of their concerns and discussions with the United States Department of Justice that caused us to join with 12 other cattle-producing states and the United States Department of Justice to oppose the merger of GBS Swift and National Beef. Just to be very precise about what our analysis of its impact on the marketplace, in the High Plains geographic market, the Beef Belt, we call it, Colorado, Western Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas, we believe that merger would have put over 85% of packer capacity in the hands of the three survivors, JBS, Tyson, and Cargill. I think the cattle producing states and DOJ jointly concluded that this would have significant anti-competitive effects at both ends of the chain. Such consolidation would force producers, ranchers, and feedlots to sell cattle for lower prices, and of course wouldn't necessarily pass along those savings to consumers. We believe that sort of consolidation allows firms to charge higher prices to grocers, food service companies. So not only the producers impacted, but the grocery store consumer is also impacted. At the state level, We can use our existing laws to protect livestock producers from anti-competitive behavior, and we'll certainly continue to very carefully monitor that. We have a Colorado Antitrust Act of 1992 that forbids monopolization and attempts to monopolize bid rigging and mergers that lessen competition. However, I want to make sure that folks in Colorado here understand a very important aspect of our Colorado antitrust law. Our office cannot challenge any merger or acquisition that has been reviewed by any federal agency under Section 7A of the Clayton Act, where the federal agency declined to challenge the merger. That was put into Colorado law in 1992. What that indicates to us is that there's a significant premium on communication between the state and federal governments, and we make sure that we convey to you fully the input we have from our agricultural community about concerns about consolidation, things like that, because the bottom line is if you decline to intervene, we're precluded from intervening. So it's very, very important that we communicate along those lines. We're aware of all the issues surrounding the GPSA proposed rules. The bottom line, it seems to me, is that what we all have to be working for is to level the playing field without overregulating in a way that disrupts the marketplace. And that's a balancing act. And we're going to very carefully monitor the conversations today and all that takes place to hope that we can assist in our comments to the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Justice in reaching that balance where we have a more level playing field and don't interfere with the marketplace by too much regulation.
Yep. The same is largely true. One of the nice things about AGs, Attorney General Southers and I, is that we're a lot closer to the grounds. We hear these concerns in our churches, in our grocery stores, when we're picking up our kids from school. Interestingly, though, and we both do a lot of work on consumer protection issues, if farmers and ranchers were like senior citizens, we'd be a lot better off, in as much as that when they have concerns, they'll be calling us. Farmers and ranchers, I think, are so used to kind of going it on their own that they're not necessarily picking up their phone to some government guy in the capital city. I think, though, that there is a lot that can be done. General Southers alluded to, actually both of them did, I mean, the calling off of JBS SWIFT. I mean, that wasn't a change of heart. That was when US DOJ and 16 states came together. And another thing that really heartens me, I guess, is that we've seen a lot more in a lot of areas, the federal government and under your leadership, General Holder, working together with the states, realizing that we're equal partners in a lot of these things. And that crosses from financial crimes to straight crime to fraud. I'm working a lot closer with my U.S. attorney than any of my predecessors ever did. This is an area, especially for our ag states, where we have to maintain that same sort of state and federal cooperation, because we will hear about what's going on in Washington. They'll look to us. And the more that we can work together, I think that the more apt. I mean, it is a real exciting time. Now we just have to make sure that we channel that excitement in constructive ways for the ag community.
Commissioner, I want to talk to you for just a second. Speaking of people that are sort of on the ground level on all of this, I come from a state that is fairly significant in hog production. And I know that when I was governor, I would hear frequently concerns about how open the market really was, when spot market prices were basically so limited, but they had such a great impact on what contracts would generate. I'm interested to know whether or not you see the same kind of activity going on or the same kind of trend going on in the cattle industry in your state, or what your thoughts are about the spot market. How do we make sure that there's sufficient integrity as the amount of that spot market shrinks?
Mr. Secretary, as I mentioned earlier, as I visit with the broad spectrum of agriculture producers in this state, I hear a number of somewhat conflicting issues from time to time. I always heard that if you get three farmers in the coffee shop, you'll get four or five opinions sometimes. So You know, as we look, I'm a wheat farmer and a cow-calf producer, and as I look back over the years, I've had the opportunity to market my calves right off the cows. I can market them as I precondition them. I can take them on to yearlings. I even have the opportunity to finish them in our own lot, which I rarely do because it's more efficient to go to commercial lots in the area. And then I can partner with them, or I can retain ownership and market them eventually as fat animals. So I've been involved in all aspects of it, and that it's important that we have as many opportunities for marketing at whatever point in the life cycle of livestock that these producers want to take advantage of the market. We all have our opinions on when we can do the best profitably. So it's important to have some transparency so we know what our options are. And if we don't know we have an option with a packer or with a retailer, it limits the opportunities that people have. And we've seen this change that we mentioned earlier of people starting to go it alone, sometimes in the form of a co-op or marketing their own animals. We have several people on the Western Slope that contract their beef production through the Internet, and they brand it with their own name. They go through a USDA-approved slaughter plant, but they retain ownership, they retain their identity. And I'm not sure that everybody can do that, but that's an opportunity that's important. And as the governor and others have mentioned, that opportunity is driven by other markets, if there's competition in the markets. And we see, as you mentioned, the export market as being very important to the meat market. Colorado ranks in the top three or four, depending on what type of meat we're exporting. When the governor went to Japan a couple of years ago, we found out that the number one product from Colorado to Japan was beef, about 24% of what they buy from our state alone. And so it's very important that we expand the global markets. China alone, we're not allowed to go in there at this point, but with 1.3 billion people, if they just ate an ounce a day, we'd really have a market that we couldn't satisfy. But we have other political barriers out there, and we appreciate what this administration's been doing with the Export Initiative, what USDA's been trying to do through the Ag Trade Offices. But as we open up global markets, I think it also opens up domestic markets, too. And it raises the overall value of beef and meat products to the producers at whatever level they decide to market, because we can't all market into the same market. And get a good profit.
Okay. Christine, I want to ask you just a real quick question just to give people a sense of what the process is in your office. You know, as you hear about information comes to your office that might suggest that there's a competitive issue, what's the analysis? What happens? How does it get handled so folks have a sense of the
sure.
factors you consider?
Well, on a merger, I think the first thing we do is we call the state AG's offices because they have the expertise on the ground, and we loop them in depending on where the merger is taking place. And a good example of that everybody referred to was JBS. You know, Secretary, we have targeted tools in the antitrust division. So we have the Sherman Act and we have the Clayton Act, which prescribe what we can do when there is a merger that substantially lessens competition. So we look at consolidation and we try to determine what's the consequence of the proposed consolidation on the competitive marketplace. We have absolutely committed to a robust enforcement of the antitrust laws. So when we see a proposed merger that we believe will meet the criteria established by the courts and the law, that it will substantially lessen competition, we will challenge the merger. It takes a while. It's a very fact-specific undertaking. We have to get a lot of testimony. We have to do a lot of economic analysis. You know, the Department of Justice employs, I think, the second or third largest number of economists in the United States government, and they're in the antitrust division. We have a very strong ag economic section where we go through a lot of the activity in the sector. We consult very closely with USDA whenever we see a merger, whether it be in livestock, poultry, grain, across the board. We then we have to go to court. We can't block a merger on our own. A judge has to agree with us. Now, in the past, when we see a merger that we believe is anti-competitive, many times the parties will simply abandon the merger. They won't go forward. Other times we have to go to court and litigate, and we put on a hell of a case, and you know, judges don't always agree with us, but we'll go to the mats, and we'll go to the mats with our partners in the states to try and prevent anti-competitive mergers. That being said, there are mergers that provide a lot of efficiency that increase competition in the marketplace, and we try to distinguish carefully those mergers that are pro-competitive and move quickly to clear those mergers through. Our doors are open. Our phones are open. I think everybody at both the USDA and the state AGs knows how to get a hold of us. When there is a merger, we want to hear your views. Our friends from the unions come in often to tell us how they see the merger impacting what they're doing. Your trade associations are always there. Every time there's a merger in an industry, I hear from the trade associations. The challenge there is there's often a diversity of opinion within the associations as to how a merger might impact its members. So we try to sort through all the information we get to the facts, and then make a decision accordingly.
Okay, we have a few more minutes, and you know, I was struck by Attorney General Bullock's comment about if farmers were more like senior citizens, the reality is that they're getting very close to that. And that raises, I think, a fundamental question that I think is important to every single person in this audience, regardless of where they come out on competition or GPSA rules or anything of that sort, and that is, how is it that we're going to get young people into this business and keep young people into this business? We cannot continue to see the trends that we've seen in the aging population within our farm families. You cannot have the percentage increase in farmers over 75 and a decrease in farmers under 25. So what I'd like to do is just very quickly go right down the line. Commissioner, I'm going to start with you and just simply ask you, you know, what do we have to do? Are you satisfied that the current market structures and systems and trends will allow young people to get into this business? And if not, what's one suggestion that you would give to us as to how we might be able to improve opportunities for young people?
As you mentioned, the statistics don't bear out that young people are returning. And to attract young people back, you have to have a variety of things. You have the opportunity of profitability is the number one thing in order to attract young people back. We also need the infrastructure of communities that have viable hospitals and good education opportunities for our young people, whether it's community colleges or just a local high school is important. So I think profitability, it starts there, and it crosses all the spectrums of commodities, especially the beef industry, because it's predominant in the High Plains area.
General?
It has to be a viable economic undertaking for the families involved, and the children have to have the assurance that they can make a living, an adequate living, in this agricultural community. Mr. Secretary, we in Colorado, water is at a huge premium, and it's very sad, and I'm sure there's farmers and ranchers in this audience here today who are facing the dilemma. As much as they want to stay on the land, have their family stay on the land, the realities of agriculture are such that their water is the most valuable commodity they have, and the temptation to sell that water for municipal use and take land out of agricultural production is tremendous. And Colorado, like many other western states, tries to present all kinds of incentives, whether it be conservation easements or whatever, to allow that to continue to happen. But at the bottom line, it's all driven by economics, and you can't blame a 65-year-old rancher whose water rights are so valuable being tempted to sell those water rights to for municipal use. And it's incumbent upon us to do everything we can to make sure this agricultural business is structured in a way that it's economic to stay on the land, to produce the food we need on that land, and reduce the incentive to simply cash out and sell the water and take the land out of agriculture.
Thank you.
you know, of course, echo the, you know, the basic fact is that it's got to be profitable for young farmers. And I talk to so many families where the son and daughter, you know, they want to stay on the land. They love the rural lifestyle, want to be married, raise their family, but just not sure if they'll be able to eke out a living. And, you know, you hear so many farmers say the behind every successful farmer is a teacher or a nurse or, quite frankly, somebody else who has a part-time job so that they can make ends meet. So certainly a system where it's, you know, we know that farmer is going to be profitable and be able to have a living for their family and be able to raise their children in an area that has good schools, has access to hospitals with the latest technologies, banks, other small businesses in the area. One of the things that I'm very happy that we have done with the Recovery Act is really focus resources on, which we did after the Great Depression, we made sure that rural communities had electricity. Right now, the next big investment in our rural communities is broadband. You know, for any community to survive, a community has to have access to the high-speed internet for your hospitals. For, you know, a child really growing up now needs to have access to the internet. So all of these things that we need to have the infrastructure in place so that our farmers and our ranchers can raise their families with the same advantages that families have in more urban communities is going to be critical. Thank you.
I'm going to skip the general to go give him the last word. So, Christine, have you any thoughts about this? Or?
As I said, Secretary, I'm here to listen. I mean, the recurring theme that we've heard in all of our workshops is the system is broken. Family farms are not sustainable. They're not able to pass farms down to their children. There's got to be a variety of solutions. Not all of them are going to reside in antitrust in the Department of Justice or in the Department of Agriculture. So I think what we're doing here is gathering information. We're taking that information back to Washington, back to our state capitals to try and figure out what a comprehensive solution is going to look like.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, again for coming. Thank you, General Holder. And I would just pick up on a couple of the comments to say, we've focused on the agricultural economy and ranching. It's important to look at ranching and farming and the different things that need to be done from a regulatory perspective to allow family farms and ranches to stay in business. But this other part of it, I think, shouldn't be missed, which is the health of rural America is at risk. It's not just ranching as an industry. And I would congratulate you, Mr. Secretary, on what you've done on rural broadband. I really think this is an important part of it. As we expand markets, as we look at global markets and say we want to access those, also allowing ranches and farms to have greater access to technology is going to happen because of rural broadband initiatives like your initiatives, and that will, over time, make a difference. We have a Main Street initiative that we've started in Colorado, and it really is about going to very small places. Fowler, Colorado, Monta Vista, Colorado, Rifle, these are all communities where we're looking and say, what's the health, what's the vibrancy of this community, how we support it. So while this is important, this part of the conversation and looking at competitiveness, consolidation, and how you have as much freedom in the marketplace for smaller producers, it's also important to look at health, look at education, look at technology, all as ways to keep kids coming back to the family farm because they understand there is this future, and it's not just about profitability, it's also just about, I think, the quality of life in rural America. So thank you for the opportunity to make these comments.
I think that ranch that I mentioned that I was at this past weekend where my mother-in-law was raised, the town of Geyser has changed substantially in the last 30 years. And all across throughout rural Montana, we're losing our schools, we're losing our banks. You know, things are getting smaller and smaller in some respects. If you look at that over the last 30 years, too, the piece of the pie that the ranchers share of the dollar has been substantially decreasing all along at the same time. So I don't think to actually make it possible for our young folks to stay on the ranch or go to the ranch, it's not going to change tomorrow. You're not going to say all of a sudden tomorrow life is going to be good, you'll have your vibrant community back. But what you need to do is offer some sort of promise or hope that that trend will reverse, that the rancher share of the food dollar will actually start going back where it was 20, 30 years ago. And then there's the opportunity to say, okay, I'm a young person, I'll take the risk because I like this lifestyle, I like what it produces for our country and for our state. But there has to be I mean, we have to reverse that trend, or if not, you sure can't blame them for wanting to get off the ranch.
General? Yeah.
You know, I think in some ways we have to return to old values, and we have to value what is done on our farms. We have to support in ways that we can, in ways that we have discussed, people who want to remain on farms, who want to pass on to their children the opportunity to do that. There's an attitudinal thing here, I think, as much as everything else that we have discussed. We have to value what happens on our farms in a way that I don't think we have in the recent past. This nation became great because we made things, we manufactured things, we grew things, we produced things, we raised livestock. That is, I think, in essence, what has defined this country and made this country great. Everybody can't be on Wall Street with these complex financial instruments. You know, that's the kind of thing that we focus a lot of our attention on and think is so great. And we have not focused on, I think, the core things that really is at the foundation of what has made this nation the leader in the world that it is. This is the 21st century, and yet I think we have to go back and think about attitudinally and what we value, some of the things from the 18th century, and what really distinguished America, and then what made this country great. And so I think it's important for us in government never to lose sight of that, to stay in touch, as I hope we are today in this this exchange, to stay in touch with the real problems of real people and come up with real world solutions for those issues. But I really do think it is a question of remembering why did this country become great? It wasn't an accident. It was because we made conscious decisions to do things that supported people, young people, in the decisions that they made to do a variety of things. And we can't concentrate our efforts, concentrate what we value on things that we find in New York City only. You know, there's a great big country out here, a great diversity in our country that we have to continue to value. And that's what I think this administration is committed to doing, and it is what we want to work with all of you all to make happen.
Okay, we're going to, thanks, General. Thank you. In an effort to keep us somewhat on schedule, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with a panel of folks who represent this rural America that has been talked about today. We'll be back in about 20 minutes.